How does our understanding of American history actually shape our present? It's a really profound question, isn't it? And it underpins so much of what we see happening today. So today on The Deep Dive, we're embarking on a really crucial exploration. We'll be sifting through a fascinating stack of sources. These are training materials and historical documents from Common Ground Conversations on Race in America. Our mission, like always, is to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, the key insights, basically offering you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed. We're talking about the foundational influences of race and religion on American society. And the aim here is to help you gain greater awareness, maybe build some trust, recognize common values. Ultimately, the goal is to empower you to become perhaps a more empathetic societal change agent. Now, to guide our discussion, these sources introduce this really powerful framework they call the Conversations Journey. It's designed to help people understand how these deep societal influences, particularly the American ones, shape our everyday decisions.
Exactly. And the sources, they really stress the importance of establishing what they call a safe, trusted space. It's like a foundation, you know, rooted in genuine curiosity. The whole goal is to go on this shared journey towards, well, greater awareness, building trust, finding common values, having those aha moments, those epiphanies, and ultimately sort of discovering common ideals. It's really about creating an environment where learning can actually happen.
Okay, so given that, how do the sources suggest that we as individuals should approach these really complex, sometimes difficult historical topics? How do we keep an open mind?
Yeah, they're pretty clear on that. Approaching this means being, well, curious first and foremost, and considerate. It's about recognizing that our individual decisions, they're not just about us, about our personal choice alone. They're deeply influenced by this whole framework of factors. I mean, think about it. The society we're in, our immediate community, our workplaces, right? The environments we spend our time in, family dynamics, personal circumstances, all of it plays a massive role. The sources really challenge that idea that decisions are just about individual personality. It's a much more interconnected picture.
That's a really vital starting point. Okay, so as we start to peel back the layers of American society, what do the sources pinpoint as the most powerful influences, the big ones that have shaped it?
They really zero in on three colossal forces: Christian beliefs, the concepts of race and culture, how they've evolved, and of course, U.S. laws. And this naturally leads us to think about a central question for this whole deep dive. What roles have Christianity and race actually played in shaping U.S. laws, not just now, but throughout history?
Okay, let's focus on a concept that feels like it underpins so much of this. The sources bring up something really surprising. A foundational insight about race itself.
They do. The sources are incredibly direct here. They state, race is a myth, a lie, a societal construct. And this isn't just like an academic footnote. It's fundamental. Race was engineered here in America. It was explicitly designed to ascribe value to humans. And that led directly to this dangerous idea that some lives are valued more than others. I mean, that completely reframes how we need to understand the basis of inequality in America.
Wow, that's a powerful statement. And to back this up, the sources mentioned Dr. Lucretia Berry in PBS confirming that racial distinctions are highly problematic because race is not biological. It even challenges how we perceive skin color, right? Black and white are names of racial groups, not literal colors. Everyone's skin, no matter the perceived race, has melanin. So every skin tone is actually just a different hue, different shade of brown.
Which immediately begs the question, okay, if race isn't biological, why on earth was it created? And the sources give a pretty stark answer. White male Europeans established the concept of race in America, and they did it to categorize people specifically, quote, in relation to power. It was a tool, essentially, a tool for social control, for hierarchy.
And it feels really important to stress here, this isn't about blame, right? Or making anyone feel guilty. The sources say this explicitly. No one should feel guilty for being who they are, what they inherited, or what their ancestors did. The point here, it seems, is to recognize what is the historical facts and their ongoing impact, and then think about how we can, quote, change what is to what could be. We can't rewrite history, obviously, but we absolutely have the power to redesign the society we want to leave behind.
Well said.
So with that foundational understanding kind of set, let's embark on the first leg of this conversation's journey. This covers the period from 1500 to 1860. That's what, 18 generations? What did sources tell us about America before it was even formally America?
Well, one really striking detail the sources bring up is the origin of the name America itself. The very first map of the continent, made back in 1507 by a German cosmographer, Martin Waldseemüller, named this New World after the Italian explorer Amerigo Vespucci. And Vespucci had pretty boldly claimed he'd discovered a continent inhabited by more numerous peoples and animals than in our Europe or Asia or Africa.
Mm.
So this act of naming, even before widespread European settlement really took hold, it was already laying a claim, wasn't it, to what was already a vibrant populated land.
And that brings us right to the doctrine of discovery.
Yeah.
This wasn't just some obscure historical thing, was it?
Not at all. This papal bull from 1493, Pope Alexander VI, basically asserted that any land not inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered, claimed, and exploited by Christian rulers.
Mm.
And later, you have Thomas Jefferson invoking it in 1792 as justification for U.S. expansion. And then it gets formally enshrined in that 1823 Supreme Court case, Johnson v. McIntosh, which ruled Europeans had an absolute right to New World lands, leaving Native Americans with only a right of occupancy. So if you connect this to the bigger picture, it's clear this doctrine was way more than just a legal idea. It became the ideological foundation for U.S. expansion. It was deeply tangled up with the belief in manifest destiny, and importantly, explicitly rooted in Christian beliefs. It fostered this ideology of racial hierarchy and white supremacy right from the very start of the nation's formation.
So when European visitors arrived and, you know, discovered these other humans like the sophisticated Powhatan chiefdom, how did those first interactions go?
Well, the sources highlight this fundamental culture clash. You had European individualism on one side valuing personal independence, accumulating wealth, hierarchical power. And on the other side, you had native collectivism valuing interdependence, group harmony, sharing resources. The native peoples who'd been here for millennia often initially met these newcomers with, you know, consideration, curiosity.
But that didn't last long, it sounds like.
No, that clash escalated into conflict pretty quickly. The European visitors weren't just surprised to find the continent already occupied. They were maybe even more surprised that no one claimed individual ownership of the land. So they just made a unilateral decision. It was going to be theirs. And the wars against Native Americans went on for nearly 300 years. These European visitors were determined to own the land, even though it clearly wasn't theirs to take. The sources give some really specific, heartbreaking examples, like how the Cow Creek and Takelma tribes in Oregon had their land seized, and how treaties like the one with the Cow Creek often weren't really understood by the tribes or were just ignored later on.
And this era, it also saw the horrific beginning of transatlantic human trafficking.
Yes. The first enslaved Black Africans arrived at Point Comfort, Virginia, back in 1619. That started 189 years of legalized human trafficking.
Which leads to a really critical point. How were Black people valued or devalued in this emerging society?
The sources make it chillingly clear. They were not considered fully human, but rather chattel, property, to be bought and sold like animals. This immediately set up this deeply ingrained racial hierarchy. Wealthy white male landowners were at the very top, and Native and Black peoples were at the very bottom. Now, there were also internal differentiations among white people too, sure, but the fundamental structure was stark.
And it's particularly striking when you look at the actual formation of the U.S. The British settlers who declared war on England in 1775, they weren't fighting for freedom for everyone, were they?
Not at all. They were fighting for power, sovereignty, and full ownership. Ownership over their own destiny, sure, but also over the lands they had built up, often with enslaved labor. The vision for this new nation was pretty clear. It was going to be a white nation with a whites-only national citizenry.
And that vision got written into law very early on.
Absolutely. It was explicitly codified. Look at the 1780 Massachusetts Constitution, drafted by John Adams, which was a model for the U.S. Constitution. It explicitly required office holders to be white European male, professing Christian, and a landowner. Those criteria for who gets to make the laws in early America. It reveals that the rule of law, from the get-go, was undeniably based on race, religion, and wealth.
Okay, let's unpack the role of law enforcement back then. How did that work?
Well, in early America, policing could be informal, like Boston's Night Watch, starting in 1636. They mostly looked out for things like prostitution or gambling, but down south, it was overtly about slave patrols. Their job was protecting the institution of slavery and, you know, business interests tied to it. And then you get things like the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, which shockingly turned ordinary watchmen into kidnappers and slave catchers. There were even broadsides warning people about this in Boston in 1851.
Wow. And even cultural symbols reflected this. You mentioned the national anthem.
Yeah, it's quite jarring. Francis Scott Key's The Defense of Fort McHenry from 1814, our national anthem. The third stanza included a hostile declaration of debt to Black people. It just highlights these starkly conflicting views of freedom, right? a symbol of victory for white Americans, but for black people, it was a chilling endorsement of oppression and white supremacy.
And speaking of defining who the people actually were in this new nation, the sources point to that infamous Supreme Court case, Dred Scott v. Sanford, in 1857.
Yeah, and the insight there is just profound and profoundly disturbing. Chief Justice Roger Taney ruled that neither the class of persons who had been imported as slaves nor their descendants were then acknowledged as a part of the people, nor intended to be included in the general words used in that memorable instrument, the Declaration of Independence. He went even further, stating they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. The court explicitly said a black person, enslaved or free, could not be an American citizen. It cemented their legal non-existence.
That ruling just paints such a stark picture of citizenship back then. Okay, so bringing it closer to home for us, how does all this connect to understanding Oregon's history specifically?
Well, the sources present Oregon literally as a white utopia. It became a state in 1859 with constitutional exclusion laws specifically targeting black people, like the infamous Lash Law of 1844, which meant black individuals could be whipped just for being in the territory illegally. And as the writer Walita Imrisha puts it, the only thing unique about Oregon is it was bold enough to write it down. Implying these kinds of ideologies, these practices, were actually pervasive across the country, even if not always spelled out quite so bluntly in law.
Okay, let's shift gears. Fast forward to Era 2, 1860 to 1880.
Yeah.
A really pivotal 20-year period. Chattel slavery has just ended. You've got 4 million newly freed black people with, as the sources say, no citizenship, no homeland, no home or land, no ownership, and no power.
Mm.
So what was the huge monumental question facing the nation at that point?
The sources label it perfectly. White America's big question, what are we going to do with black people? It was this moment of profound uncertainty, especially for the existing power structure. But interestingly, within this chaos, they highlight a paradigm shift, the unexpected rise of what they call white radicals in Congress.
Okay, this is a really surprising turn in the story. These white radicals.
Yeah.
They weren't like mainstream white Americans who wanted to keep the status quo, keep white supremacy.
No, quite the opposite. They believed in the equal value of all humans. They actually fought for systemic change to try and establish a truly inclusive society. They advocated for an America where black people should be full citizens, equal in every way to white citizens. And their vision, really, it aligns almost perfectly with what we talk about today as diversity, equity, and inclusion DEI.
So who are these white radicals?
Well, the sources point to some really towering figures. Thaddeus Stevens, for example, a huge advocate for free schools, and he was key in impeaching President Andrew Johnson precisely because Johnson opposed black empowerment. There was also Charles Sumner, another powerful ally who was actually physically assaulted right on the Senate floor for his anti-slavery speeches. And beyond Congress, they talk about radical friends like John Brown, the Christian abolitionist, and Frederick Douglass. Both played absolutely pivotal roles in pushing beyond just ending slavery. They risked their lives for black economic and political empowerment.
So how did this radical shift actually impact the Civil War itself?
Well, the sources reveal something quite significant. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation wasn't just a moral stance. It was actually a critical war strategy. Mm-hmm. It was designed to secure a Union victory. And to make that happen, it directly relied on 200,000 black men fighting for their freedom and 300,000 black people serving in support roles. Their participation was absolutely essential to propel the Union Army to victory.
And what's truly remarkable, almost unbelievable about this period, is that for 7 years, during its called Black Reconstruction, roughly 1865 to 1872, Congress actually prioritized the economic and political empowerment of black people.
It's incredible, isn't it? The only time in U.S. history that happened.
The only time.
Yeah. It was brief, but incredibly impactful. This focus led to really significant achievements. You get 8 civil rights laws, including the big ones, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Those abolished slavery, granted citizenship, and secured voting rights for black men. They also set up the Freedmen's Bureau, which the sources describe as the first federally funded DEI program. This led to building black towns, establishing historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, and real substantial gains in black political representation across the South.
And the Statue of Liberty, its meaning often gets kind of muddled in the popular story.
Yeah. It really does. The sources clarify that France gifted it to the U.S. specifically to commemorate the freedom of black people in America and the death of chattel slavery. That's why you see the broken shackles at her feet. It was unveiled in 1886, a full 6 years before Ellis Island even opened as an immigration center. That really underscores its original meaning. tied to emancipation.
But if we connect this era back to the bigger sweep of history, this period of radical Reconstruction, it faced immediate and really fierce opposition.
Oh, absolutely. Immediate and ferocious. President Andrew Johnson issued a mass presidential pardon to former Confederates, systematically trying to undermine everything the radicals were doing. He aggressively pushed the fear of Negro rule and Negro supremacy among white Americans. And you had figures like Sidney George Fisher publishing books like The Laws of Race as connected with slavery, trying to reinforce the pseudoscience of white supremacy and this idea of a divinely created racial hierarchy. It was this intense ideological battle. And ultimately, the enormous efforts to really transform America failed when those white radicals eventually lost power.
Which brings us then to our final leg, Era 3. This spans from 1880 all the way to the present day, about seven generations. What happened when the white radicals lost power and the white supremacists regained control?
Well, it marked the beginning of a devastating period the sources call a reign of white terrorism, running roughly from 1868 to 1968, a whole century. During this time, Jim Crow laws, named after that grotesque minstrel show caricature and various black codes, essentially criminalized just being black in America. This led to legalized racial segregation and just a staggering death toll. The sources estimate 53,000 black Americans slaughtered by 1895. This era was defined by widespread vigilantism, lynchings, riots, and deeply institutionalized violence.
And the sources give a really chilling specific example of this reversal of progress, the story of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898.
Yes, it's a moment that's often glossed over, but it's incredibly significant. It was a violent overthrow of a democratically elected government, a government that had a black majority population overthrown by white supremacists. They didn't just disrupt things. They issued their own white Declaration of Independence, proclaiming they would no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin. They destroyed the black-owned newspaper, the Daily Record. They killed dozens, maybe hundreds of black residents. They installed their own mayor and immediately enacted Jim Crow laws. Wilmington never got its black majority back. And black political representation in North Carolina effectively vanished for 90 years. It was basically a blueprint for how to violently reverse black empowerment.
And this wasn't just isolated violence. The sources highlight these really influential voices of white supremacy that continued to shape the 20th century. It shows how deep this ideology ran.
Oh, absolutely. Take Father Charles Coughlin, a Catholic priest. He reached an astonishing 30 million listeners on national radio back in the 1930s, and he was actively promoting white power, racial hierarchy. He was even noted as the hero of Nazi Germany. Then you have Charles Lindbergh, the American aviation hero. He openly promoted white supremacist ideology, even collaborated on a book with a known eugenicist, and was honored by Nazi Germany. These were not fringe figures. They were mainstream.
And this influence wasn't just individuals, right? There were organizations, too.
Exactly. The German-American Bund, for instance, they claimed to be 100% American, but advocated for a white Gentile-ruled America. They grew rapidly, holding huge rallies across the country. The sources even mention this shocking 1944 sedition trial where 24 members of Congress were actually indicted for laundering Nazi propaganda. It reveals just how deep this white nationalist ideology penetrated, even at the highest levels of government.
So broadening out again, how did this entrenched ideology affect policy and violence beyond just black Americans?
That's an important point. The sources mention the 278 years of wars against Native Americans, which didn't just end in the 19th century. They continued well into the 20th. Plus, there were overt white supremacist wars against Chinese peoples, leading directly to things like the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, a landmark piece of racist legislation. And that was followed by severe immigration restrictions and hostility towards Japanese, Korean, and other Asian populations, nearly barring them from citizenship and land ownership. It was a broad application of this hierarchy.
Okay, so given all this history, this deep context, what does it all mean for policing in America today?
Well, the sources state it unequivocally. Policing in America is steeped in a history of white supremacy. It literally originated from slave patrols in the South and has this long, deeply embedded culture of enforcing discriminatory laws like the Black Codes or enforcing rules in sundown towns where black people were forbidden after dark.
Let's bring it back to Oregon again for a moment. The sources detail specific racist housing practices in Portland.
Yes, like the 1919 Portland Realty Board mandate that explicitly told realtors not to sell property to black or Asian populations in designated white neighborhoods. This systematically forced black residents into very specific, often less desirable areas, like Albina.
And then the Vanport flood in 1948.
Right. That flood displaced over 18,000 residents. A third of them were Black. It further concentrated these displaced Black residents into already marginalized areas. It essentially destroyed existing Black prosperity, existing community structures that had been built up.
And this systematic destruction of Black wealth and opportunity, it continued through both public and private sector policies for decades.
Absolutely. Post-World War II, federal investment in freeways often literally just razed Black communities to make way for highways. And practices like redlining and restrictive covenants systematically denied Black Americans fair access to homeownership and economic mobility. This created these chronic conditions of deprivation and inequality that, frankly, persist today.
When we connect this to the bigger picture, then, these chronic conditions, the systemic inequality, it directly fueled the Negro Revolution in 1963.
Exactly. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s powerful book, Why We Can't Wait, details how this wave of nonviolent direct action protests just erupted in nearly 1,000 cities across America. It genuinely took white America by surprise. They had grown accustomed to, perhaps, a more compliant Black citizenry. This was different.
And just to remind listeners, what were the core demands of that revolution? What were they asking for?
The sources lay out three fundamental demands. They were crucial for overcoming Black oppression and achieving real equality. They were end segregation in schools, end discrimination in housing, and end discrimination in banking and access to capital. These weren't minor tweaks. They were challenges to the entire system.
What's particularly sobering, though, is the description of the white backlash that followed this push for change.
It was incredibly intense. In 1966, a poll showed that 72% of white Americans did not like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and that negative sentiment actually worsened for the rest of his life. This animosity just escalated into the long, hot summer of 1967, with riots breaking out in 164 cities across 34 states. A presidential panel, the Kerner Commission, famously reported that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it. So you have this environment of an impatient Black America demanding change, met with violent white responses. And this directly led to Richard Nixon getting elected in 1968 on a law and order platform, signaling a shift back towards stricter enforcement.
And this whole historical arc, it leads us right up to today, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The sources connect that historical fight by the white radicals for what we now call DEI to very current debates.
Absolutely. You see significant opposition today from figures like Elon Musk, Bill Ackman, Stephen Miller. They claim DEI is racist or an improper ideology. The sources even highlight recent executive orders aimed at, quote, removing improper ideology and terminating DEI offices and programs in federal agencies. It really echoes those historical efforts to roll back progress.
So if we look at current conditions, does the data reflect these ongoing systemic issues?
It absolutely does. The data makes it starkly clear. The sources show that children from what they term the most vulnerable populations, MVP children, are pretty much ubiquitously served by the worst quality schools. And this is despite living in the world's richest nation. The Black-white homeownership gap, still a massive 28.5%. Black-owned businesses make up only 2% of total U.S. employers, even though Black entrepreneurship is consistently growing. And banks, they are still fined by the federal government consistently for discriminatory practices. It's ongoing. The sources even cite a Citibank report estimating a truly staggering $21 trillion in lost GDP because of ongoing discrimination. $21
trillion. Wow. We've covered centuries of American history here, from the initial artificial concept of race to its profound and really persistent impact on laws, systems, societal structures. It's been a heavy journey, for sure, but filled with absolutely crucial insights for understanding where we are right now.
Yeah. And when you reflect on this whole journey, I think the powerful takeaway the sources offer is that, well, none of us individually created the complex society we inherited, right? But we do now bear this profound responsibility for the one we choose to pass on to future generations.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? The sources really urge us all to be curious and proactive in learning more, to commit to learn more and listen to the voices of oppression, and maybe to identify one radical thing you can do in your current capacity, one thing you can do to improve conditions for the most vulnerable populations. It's about taking some kind of action, however small it might feel, from wherever you are.
So maybe consider this. If systems awareness means really understanding how these inherited laws, policies, practices can benefit some groups while harming others, what is one concrete societal system rooted in that historical racial hierarchy we talked about that you now see differently after this deep dive? And perhaps what's one small step you could potentially take to disrupt its status quo just a little bit for the benefit of everyone?